Good morning, good morning, good morning. How are we doing out there in Radio Land today? You're listening to X-Ray FM. It's KXRY Portland. X-Ray FM. X-Ray operates the following translators: K296 FT West Haven, that's 107.1 FM here in Portland, and K219 KU Nehalem. That's 91.7 FM on the coast, Nehalem, Wheeler, Manzanita, Rockaway Beach. Online everywhere at xray.fm. My name is Chase. I'll be here with you for the next couple of hours, hanging out, doing some radio with you this morning. That track we led the show off with was called Stay in Your Lane by Courtney Barnett. It's new music by Courtney Barnett. I enjoyed that one. What did you think? Hey, it's 45 degrees, foggy here in Portland. Get a high of 64 today. There is a fog advisory until 11 a.m. So be careful. That's what we want you to know about the fog. 43 degrees in Tillamook. Out at the Tillamook Weather Station, high of 66 out there. And guess what? Fog advisory and a beach hazard statement in effect until tomorrow at 5 p.m. Sneaker waves possible. Be careful. The sneaker waves are no joke. If you live out there on the coast, I probably don't need to tell you that, but you know, if you're one of us inland people and you're thinking about going out to the coast, be careful out there. The sneaker waves, they come up fast and they can wash you out. It's bad. You got to pay attention to it. Take those warnings seriously. Well, hey, it is the fun drive time here at X-Ray, which is a very special time where we ask you for money. It's not easy. It's hard. Nobody likes being asked for money, but it is important. And I really like the fun drive time because it is an opportunity to talk a little bit more deeply about what is going on in the world, how it affects the station, why it informs our work. You know, it's a good time to talk a bit more about what we do and why it's important. So I relish the opportunity at times because we get to lift back the curtain a bit. And in my role as the station manager, station director, you know, that means I get to talk a little bit more deeply about the work that I do and the work that X-Ray is embarking on. Not just what we do day to day, but the projects we want to undertake and where I see this thing fitting into the general media landscape, which of course has been crazy. So we'll talk a little bit about that today here on the show. We also got One Battle After Another, part one. That's from Angle of View today. So that's coming up. We also got the news here on X-Ray in a second. I'll take another 60 seconds to talk to you about the fun drive, though. You know, it's day 12, and we're trying to raise $40,000 to support the station. And we're on our way. We raised a little under $3,000 yesterday, which is really, really good. And I know we can do that again today. So head on over to the website, xray.fm, and pledge your support. The phone lines won't open until about 9 a.m. So do the website until then. We got a $1,000 goal again today, and I know we can blow past that. You know, our mission is to put a microphone to the best of Portland and the coast. And supporting the station provides a platform for local music, news, arts, and culture, all made by members of your community. On top of that, everyone that gives from now until midnight on Friday, October 24th, so this week, can be entered to win a month-long in-home pinball machine rental from our friends at Wedgehead and Out of Order Amusement. I was like, what's a long pinball? But it's a month-long pinball rental from Wedgehead and Out of Order Amusement. I'll figure out what the machine is this time. Last time it was Lord of the Rings. It's probably that again. Also, any new or existing members that donate during the drive will be entered into the grand prize, a Movie Madness Miniplex rental, where the winner and up to 18 of their friends can have a private film screening at Movie Madness with state-of-the-art 4K laser projection and Dolby Atmos sound. How exciting would that be? And I want to do a quick plug for the $20 a month level of membership. If you're a listener of X-Ray, Becoming a member at $20 a month is really supportive of the station. We value that at about $240, and it's very easy for us to make our goal if people sign up for that $20 a month level. X-Ray has to pay for a lot of things, and that really, really helps us. Prices of things have going up. X-Ray is taking on, frankly, we hope to take on a little bit more investment to do something really, really cool. And it will mean a little bit higher overhead, so you can help the station invest in that growth and that direction. There are some details we got to work out before we make it official or publicly announce what it is. But you can help out with that. And also at that level, you get this very cool zip-up hoodie. It's like it's a forest green. It's got a custom hand-drawn image on the back of tomatoes grown out of a can that says "Radio is yours" on the can. It has some cool X-Ray FM font. I'm very excited about it. It's a really, really cool piece of apparel that I'm looking forward to adding to my collection. It's got the X-Ray logo on the front, so people know you're supporting the station and that you supported the station at a really generous level. So that's my recommendation. Sign up for that $20 a month level. Love to get two people do it during the show today, this morning, before Tom gets on the air. So do that, please, and help out the station. Thank you. We'll talk more about what that all means here later in the show. But before we do anything else, we're going to do our public service. We've got the news here at X-Ray FM. Thanks for tuning in this morning.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for October 21st, 2025. I'm Joe Willery. Crews began tearing down part of the White House East Wing to make space for President Donald Trump's planned ballroom. The Associated Press reports the East Wing, long home to the First Lady's offices, now shows heavy damage as demolition continues. Work started in September, and the White House says it doesn't need outside approval for tearing down the structure. The National Capital Planning Commission, which usually reviews major projects, hasn't approved new construction. The 90,000 square foot ballroom is expected to hold about 1,000 guests. Iowa seniors who use Medicare face coverage changes for the upcoming year. Health advocates are encouraging people to review their options during the open enrollment period that runs until December 7th. AARP Iowa State Director Michael Wagler says it's important to review the available options because plans and coverage may have changed.
That includes the drugs that are covered, monthly premium charges, and even what pharmacies are considered in-network.
He says they are working with the Iowa Senior Health Insurance Information Program to help people understand their options and feel secure during what can be a confusing process.
And unfortunately, scammers know this as well, and they will often try to scam Medicare beneficiaries during this period.
Wagler adds that Medicare will never call beneficiaries requesting personal information and says it's important never to engage with anyone calling claiming to represent Medicare or asking for enrollment numbers. As the influential rise of the white Christian nationalism movement can be seen across the country, a Wisconsin-based law expert argues the solution hinges on the separation of church and state. The extremist ideology, which experts say has ties to the MAGA movement, asserts that America is and must remain a Christian nation. Andrew Seidel with Americans United for Separation of Church and State argues Christian nationalism is a sinister, exclusionary movement attempting to redefine America and reshape its laws. He stresses it distorts both the Christian faith and the country's constitutional democracy.
Christian nationalism is not the same as Christianity. So not every Christian is a Christian nationalist. Really important to make that distinction.
White Christian nationalism is a subset of Christian nationalism that asserts the white race and culture is superior. Research shows these views are most prevalent in Midwestern and Southern states that voted for President Trump. About 30% of Wisconsinites are white Christian nationalists, according to the Public Religion Research Institute. This is Public News Service. North Carolinians are speaking up as state Republicans rush to change the congressional voting map and improve their chances in the midterms next year. Eric Tekedoff has more.
The map largely impacts Congressional District 1, which was the site of the only competitive congressional election in North Carolina in 2024. The map would decrease black representation in particular, Tyler Day with Common Cause North Carolina says the proposed map decreases the black voting age population of the district by 8%.
Representative Don Davis, a Democrat, won Congressional District 1 by less than 2 percentage points in 2024. The new map was drawn specifically to oust Representative Davis and make it easy for a Republican to win.
Republicans in the General Assembly have made clear why they want to make this change. It's likely to gain them a seat in the U.S. House, as State Republican Senator Ralph Heiss, who is serving as Senate Deputy President, has stated. The House Redistricting Committee is scheduled to meet today at 2 p.m. The General Assembly is accepting comments from the public on the plan.
Advocates for working families in New Hampshire say a prolonged government shutdown could harm the more than 70,000 residents who rely on SNAP benefits.
Federal officials warn the food assistance program will run out of money at the end of the month and have not said whether they'll step in to ensure payments continue. Lucas Meyer with the nonprofit Our Economy, Our Future says tax cuts for high earners and corporations have left the state with little revenue to shore up public services.
A lot of folks right now are feeling the squeeze, but that has also been the reality for a lot of working people in this state and in this country for a long time.
He says tax cuts for the ultra wealthy have drained more than $1 billion from the state budget over the past decade, leaving communities with inadequate housing, child care, and health care. Two rural health centers in Franconia and Canaan have already announced their closure due to federal Medicaid cuts. I'm Catherine Carley.
Farm Aid, the annual concert program that raises money to support America's family farms, is celebrating its 40th year of great music and benevolence. One advocacy group, the Missouri Rural Crisis Center, has worked with the concert series every step of the way. The center supports the state's independent family farms and rural communities with programs that help ensure for market, support the environment, and preserve the rural lifestyle. The center's Rhonda Perry says her group was started with a grant from Farm Aid.
Farm Aid has very thoughtfully over the years ensured that the event wasn't just a concert, but was an event that has ways for people to engage and take action right there at the concert.
She says Farm Aid cut a $10,000 check to help the center get up and running in the mid-1980s. This is Joe Ullery for Public News Service, member and listener supported. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And in local from Public News Service, Fed housing cuts threaten vulnerable Oregon populations.
The Trump administration plans to make large cuts to permanent housing supports and direct funding instead to temporary housing assistance with requirements for work or service. That's according to leaked documents from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. HUD estimates the changes to the continuum of care funding would strip more than 170,000 people of their housing assistance. Laura Golino de Lovato is with Northwest Pilot Project in Multnomah County. She says COC funding is critical for helping the state's most vulnerable populations to find housing, including seniors, families, survivors of domestic violence, and youth.
We're likely to see more people staying in shelter longer, more people becoming homeless, and more people facing eviction. And it is driven very much by what is happening at the federal level.
Oregon was awarded about $65.5 million in continuum of care grants last year, distributed among the state's five regional COC programs. Under the new plan, overall funding for the program would stay the same, but funds to support permanent housing would be reduced to less than a third. Proponents of prioritizing temporary housing say the change is intended to promote self-sufficiency. Golina De Lovato says that idea does not reflect reality.
That argument might hold water if wages were very high and rent was extremely low, and if human beings didn't age and have disabilities.
She explains there are people who will never be able to make enough money through work to support themselves and their families, especially in areas where rent is high. But Golino De Lovato says even though the situation is bleak, support from wealthy individuals and a regional high earner in business tax give her hope that Oregon's spirit of compassion will pull the state through this challenging time.
There are people who care in our community who don't want to see youth and families with children and seniors homeless or in shelter. And I really think that together we're going to find a way to get there.
For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
This is Angle of View. Today is October 21st, 2025. I'm Will Hatman. It's time for another Angle of View First, a two-parter. Yes, the good news is that my one battle after another review begins today. The bad news is that it doesn't conclude until next week. You might have noticed that this movie is a pretty big deal, big enough that its impact crater continued to expand over the first 2 weeks that I spent writing about it, such that the goal line kept running away from me. I could have talked myself into abandoning the review completely, but that would have been a dereliction of duty. However, I also can't bring myself to cut it down, and since my remarks won't fit into a single 15 to 25 minute show, you're only getting part one today. Please note that these dire and pessimistic opening paragraphs were written before the No Kings protests of this past weekend. I had the pleasure of participating in that event and came out feeling a great deal better about the state of U.S. politics than I have at any time since our national nightmare resumed in January. The fact that my review opens with a description of a recent dream which appeared to confirm for me that protest is useless does not mean that I would actually argue as much, and especially not now. I just think it was significant that the pessimism had sunk so deep into my brain prior to that, deep enough to require the kind of jolt that the weekend offered me. As it happens, I will argue that the main reason for the enormity of the public response to this movie has to do with it giving audiences that same kind of jolt. You'll see. Here we go. The other night, I dreamed I was walking around in some downtown somewhere when I saw a massive protest march rippling toward me like an ocean wave. I let it sweep me up into a spot near the front, and it felt good. Our throng walked boldly and noisily for about a quarter of a mile down whatever street it was, somehow not noticing that the landscape was changing beneath our feet. Before we could determine how we got there, we were at the foot of a huge staircase, and then we were mounting it, getting quieter as confusion set in. When we got to the top, we were at the edge of a cliff. The whole procession just stopped and looked around in what was now total silence. And the only thing we could see, another quarter mile away along the ridge, was another staircase leading back down. In a more stable time, I might not be so eager to read into this dream, but it's equally possible that in a more stable time, I might not have had it in the first place. At this time in our shared reality, we Americans are heavily into our worst political crisis in living memory, perched gravely on the precipice of post-democratic autocracy, and I can't help noticing that our anger and resentment over being treated this way aren't doing us much good. We're being hollowed out from the inside by a small cadre of sadists and billionaires pulling the strings on a demented con man, and every sane and decent subject of this regime is full of ill feeling about it. But this ill feeling is not easily focused or even organized. The regime is historically unpopular, but institutions continue to capitulate to it at the faintest suggestion of pressure, and the opposition party still can't find its way to a message. Those with the power to do something are showing us daily that they have no core values and/or no working thermometer. They monopolize all the oxygen of dissent, but they use it to blow the cobwebs off platitudes about the precise kind of peaceful coexistence that is no longer possible when the faction in power is actively ridding the country of the kinds of people it doesn't like. And those with the passion to do something have no power and don't know what to do or who to get involved with in order to attain power. An instinctual grasp of game theory, an understanding of the necessity of a critical mass of people in order for ideas to break through, and the seeming impossibility of gathering that mass, keeps everyone at home. It feels as though our revolutionary spirit has been conditioned out of us. That supposed spark in our collective psyche, championed by Jefferson, and long thought inextricable from our own self-definition, that freedom reflex by which Americans would theoretically never tolerate getting jerked around and brutalized like this, seems to have atrophied under decades of material comforts so thick and cushy and seemingly inexhaustible that at a deep level we began seeing them as our God-given right, and more precious than our freedom, or maybe the same thing as it, the enjoyment of treats as an ethos. Add to this the loneliness we took on when we abandoned our human communities to begin living online, and a mass culture so ideologically dominated by capital that new political ideas are reduced to advertising slogans before they've finished forming, and suddenly the only plane on which we feel we have any control at all over the terms of our lives is media consumption. This is why we moralize and police media consumption choices so vigorously, always breathing fire over the movies and shows and video games that are woke or, on the other side, problematic. Because the arena where our moral values are supposed to manifest and do battle, politics, is off limits to us. Everything there is predetermined and out of our hands. Even though what goes on in Washington now constitutes a radical departure from the passive neoliberal rot that preceded it, the one thing the two power structures have in common is that it feels to you and me like we had no choice about either one. We are as frogs in the pot, caught in a situation that began before we can remember, and that on any given day seems as bad as it could possibly be while still guaranteed to be worse tomorrow. We want to fight the power, but the terms of the fight utterly overwhelm and baffle us. We're thrashing in the water and wouldn't know what direction to swim in, even if we could find the surface. Morale is at an all-time low and is stuck there, joined to our political inaction in a frigid equilibrium. We increasingly self-medicate with entertainment to make the slog bearable, but unfortunately, the other thing that's become paralyzed and joined to the other two nodes in the equilibrium is our culture, which has gone into so deep a stasis that its bed sores are achieving sentience. We have suffered so long under an inability to produce or at least to admit the new that our malnutrition has advanced to end-stage symptoms like generative AI, which is contempt for the new, made manifest and productized. And even as the streaming dreck still mollifies us enough to take the edge off the day, we can feel the rot setting in here too. And so what we yearn for more and more in our entertainment is nearly the opposite of mollification, something that will rattle us, jar us out of our stupor and into rediscovery of our strength and our fragile, beautiful humanity. And we increasingly don't care what that something is or how it arrives. I think it is largely for this reason that Paul Thomas Anderson's new movie, One Battle After Another, is hitting American moviegoers so hard. Actually, I think there are two reasons lurking inside the one, two ways in which the movie is making audiences feel alive. The first is the immediate matter of how it hits you. By the old-fashioned methods of its production and the undeniable talent of its director, One Battle After Another feels, in the basics of its visual language, like it has that power to jar. It is so well made and so happy about its little humanizing imperfections, handheld jerks, momentary losses of focus, overexposures, that it registers as more vital than anything brought to us by a Hollywood studio in a long time. This is certainly part of the reason that it's the most talked about movie in years. The last time the box office generated a fervor like this was the weekend of Barbenheimer, and the white-hot lighting, thrumming kinesis, and gorgeously coarse VistaVision textures of Anderson's film make both of those summer 2023 releases look like the kind of slick trash that plays in a pop-up window while you hunt for the X. Anderson directs it with a kind of molten bravado that has always animated his best work. His dramatic methods translate to the action thriller genre so well that they may as well have been born there, and this is one of the most exciting discoveries to be enjoyed while watching it. Comparisons to the likes of Leone and Kurosawa have swirled around the most thrilling sequences in the movie, although even more amazing is that its single most thrilling sequence, a car chase along a hilly stretch of desert blacktop, is startlingly new, with cameras strapped to the car's front bumpers taking you on a dizzying tour of the road's undulations that is unlike anything you've ever experienced in a movie. This sequence, which is enough by itself to make the film worth seeing on the big screen just for the visceral rush, is the kind of feat that not only reminds you of what movies can do, but of the fact that there are still new ways for them to do them. It's an extremely exciting movie, and I'm grateful for it, not just as a viewing experience, but as a signal of possible change in Hollywood. Its early success for Warner Brothers might inspire more studios to start trusting directors again. But this isn't what most people are talking about when they come out of the theater raving about it. The content of One Battle After Another is getting 10 times the attention and praise of its style. And while I understand this completely, and even agree that it opens to the more interesting discussion, I also think the praise on this score is undeserved, and much more revealing of the new needs of the American film audience than of any power on the film's part to satisfy those needs. It acknowledges them, but that's all. This is the first movie to be released in America's fascist era that tells the fascists where to stick it. The bad guys in this movie are U.S. military personnel and their paramilitary reserve forces who are terrorizing the residents of a small town in California and whose agenda is being set by a small secret society of white supremacists. And the heroes are anti-fascist militants who refuse to let themselves be pushed around by these people. America could not be more ready for a movie like this. The spot where it hits us is raw and red. But as a political object, it's much too facile to bear the weight we're heaping onto it. It's our hunger that's doing it. And while Anderson's intentions are clear enough through the murk that you can be sure he thought he was giving us exactly the meal that we needed, and that the movie's legion of fans insists we received, it doesn't quite fill the stomach. Its shortcomings also have enough in common with those of Anderson's past work to remind you of what has always made him a frustrating artist to follow and admire. The imperfections in his visual style are deliberate and make it endearing, like a home-cooked meal. But the imperfections in his storytelling are the regular kind. The movie is inspired by Thomas Pynchon's Vineland, a novel that is its author's reckoning with the failure of 60s counterculture. Published in 1990 and set in 1984, the book follows some bumbling and self-